So we're studying in the book of James in chapter 4, and we are in verse 8 now, as we were covering verse 7 last week and got into verse 8. So just so we can refresh ourselves on the context of where we are in our study, verses 6 through 8 we want to read now from James 4. But he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. So in verse 7, as we saw, building on principle that he taught in verse 6, that God resists the proud and gives his grace to the humble, this is encouraging us to be humble. And since that is the case, that God is going to give his grace, his favor, to those who humble themselves, in verse 7 he says, submit yourselves therefore to God. So we have to do that. That's how we're going to demonstrate our humility, by putting ourselves in subjection to God. And as we saw, that is to arrange ourselves under him in an orderly manner. So whatever he teaches us to do, he has full authority over us. And so then if we're humble, we're going to submit to his authority. He made us. Is it humble for us if we have been created by God, as we all have, if we say, well, Lord, you made me, but I'm going to take this life you've given me, and now I'm going to use it as I please. Is that humble? That's not humble. But if we acknowledge our Creator, and we seek him, and we acknowledge the authority he has over us, then if we're saying, Lord, you made me, and I will follow your will in all things, and then do that. That's humility. So he tells us to submit ourselves, therefore, to God. And very clearly, that is to God. That's what the humility is. We're not to submit ourselves, put ourselves into subjection to any other authority, because there isn't one. Now, God expresses his authority in a manner of ways, which we went over that last week. So when children are submitting to their parents, and so in the family relationships with children to parents, wives to husbands, or with us and the governmental authorities, with us and our authorities and our vocations, our jobs. I mean, there's authority structure in so many aspects of our lives that is all covered in the scriptures, and it's reflective of God's authority. So we're submitting to God by submitting to those authorities he puts over us. But as far as any other, if anyone is trying to get us to subject ourselves to something that's outside of God's authority and what he teaches, then are we to submit ourselves to that? If it's God or man, I mean, what do we choose? Or who do we choose? We have to choose the Lord. So that's why he says we need to show our humility by submitting ourselves to God. There will be times when there will be certain men that will say, okay, if you the way you should submit to God is to submit to me. And there are a lot of false teachers that do that. You see, there are lots of crazy things people have done in the practice of religion by following somebody's leadership that was claiming to be doing God's will and teaching God's will in his word. And so then they called them to show that by following them. That's not submitting ourselves to God. We have to make sure that it is the Lord's authority, and that we're doing what God says to do, not what somebody is doing claiming on their own and attaching the Lord's name to it. So we're to submit ourselves to God, and he said, and what goes along with that? If we're going to submit ourselves to God, who can we not be submitting to? Well, obviously the devil. That's the other possible spiritual father we can have. We're either going to be children of God or children of the devil, as we have examined in our study here. And the Lord tells us that over and over again in his word, and teaches that in so many places and ways. So when we are submitting ourselves to God to do what he says, well, the devil's trying to entice us to do something other than what God says. This is the way it's been since the garden in Genesis 3, when God said to not eat of that fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He said, in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. God said that in Genesis 2, and so in Genesis 3, there's the devil through that serpent. What did he say to Eve? Thou shalt not surely die. Adds the word not in there. Of course, contradicting what God says to deceive Eve, to get her to disobey the Lord. So in order to submit ourselves to God, what goes along with that that we see brought out there in verse 8? Or the last part of verse 7, rather. Resist the devil. And if we resist the devil, then what's the devil going to do? He's going to flee from us. Now, does that mean he's going to flee from us forever? No. But when the Lord has given permission for the devil to bring certain temptations upon us, and is that how it works? I mean, does the devil have free reign, and can he do whatever he pleases? No. What would happen to us if he were able to do all that he desired? No, we wouldn't be here. His power would easily overwhelm us. We would not be able to endure that then. We do have God that does put restrictions on the devil, as we know. The Lord's the one that's in full control of what the devil is able to do. When Jesus was speaking to the Apostle Peter, and this was before his crucifixion, Peter was expressing his willingness to die for the Lord. That was his will, that was his mind. I mean, was that, and he said that he was ready to die with him. Was he sincere in what he was professing there? Well, in Luke 22:33, Peter said, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both into prison and to death. Was he just saying words? That was his conviction. I mean, it was utterly sincere. Now, in the course of Peter's life, he did all of that, didn't he? Did he end up in prison for the Lord's sake? Yes, he certainly did. Read Acts 12. The Lord made that miracle occur where he brought that earthquake to open the doors of the... That's Philippi, Acts 16. Acts 12, he sent his angel to lead Peter out of the prison there in Jerusalem, and made the chains fall off of him and led him right out of there. That's what the Lord did. But Peter was in prison for the Lord's sake. Herod was ready to kill him. What ended up happening to Peter ultimately? How did he leave this earth? Well, we don't have the event recorded as it happened in the New Testament, but we have the Lord's prophecy of it in John 21. And when he told Peter that when he was old, he was going to be taken where he would not rather go. And he was signifying his death. He was going to be put to death for the Lord. Peter understood that. We see reference to that prophecy also in 2 Peter chapter 1, as he was on the eve of that happening. I mean, very, very close to it happening. And so he said he was going to be putting off this my tabernacle, that physical body. He said, as the Lord had spoken. So we know that Peter was put to death for the faith. So did he? He said, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both into prison and to death. He did. But was he strong enough to do that night? That was his mind, but he was not strong enough at that point. Did he grow in strength to where he was able to do that? When that's what the Lord, that was what the Lord's will was for him? Yes. So he certainly grew. But in Luke 22, verse 31, the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. What would he like to do with all of us? He'd love to be able to take us and just and shake us and do with us fully to destroy us according to his power. But how come Satan wasn't doing that with Simon? And why aren't we all destroyed? Because God, greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. God is greater than Satan. In the book of Job, how does that book begin? Was it God's will for Job to be tempted? It was. Who brought Job up when the devil presented himself before the Lord? Who introduced the subject of Job, God's servant Job? Nay, God did. Satan, Job 1 verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. Doing what? Seeking whom he may devour of God's children. And did he know Job? He knew Job. He knew Job very well, as he's going to show here. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? Well, what's the answer to the question? Had Satan considered Job? He had. And he said in verse 9, then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. And then the devil did just that. But the devil was, he said that God had put a hedge around. He had a fence around Job. I mean, who made the fence? God did. Could Satan, when God put a fence around him, could Satan do anything about the fence? Nothing. Only when what happened? When God removed the fence. And so God removed the fence from around all that Job had. He made the fence a lot smaller. He put it around Job himself and would not let Satan touch Job personally. Chapter 2, the fence gets even smaller as he lets the devil touch Job, but not to take his life. But in all of that, God was in full control of what the devil could do. Now, was it God's will that Job face temptations? Yes, just like all of us. I mean, God didn't put us into this world where there's no devil and where we can't go through the test for God to see whether we love him or not. If there's no devil to tempt us not to serve God, what are we all going to do? We're all going to serve God. Does God need to know whether we will willingly do that? He does. And how does he accomplish that? Well, he's put us in this flesh, and and this is why it's necessary that there is evil in the world. It's according to God's purposes, so he can know. I mean, that's the reason he says that they're false teachers that are in this world. I mean, that's the reason. And who's behind the false teachers? False teachers, false. They tell lies. Well, who's the father of lies? Who's the one lying, using them to tell the lies? I mean, it's the devil. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 13, the Lord tells why that is. He warned them about these false teachers. Deuteronomy 13, starting in verse 1, if there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and giveth thee a sign or wonder, and the sign of the wonder come to pass, whereof he spake unto thee, saying, let us go after other gods, which thou hast not known, let us serve them. Thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God proveth you, that's the word for test, to know whether you love the Lord with God with all your heart and with all your soul. So how does he know whether we truly love him with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength, which is the great commandment that we do that? How does he know? Well, when we choose to do that, in spite of all the temptations to do otherwise, and we show the Lord over and over again that we're making that choice, no, I love the Lord, I'm going to do what he says, and reject all of the temptations to do something other than that, well, then the Lord is going to know that we love him with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. But if we were all put here in this world and there's no temptation, how would the Lord know whether we're doing it just because we don't have any other choice, or whether we're doing that because we willingly choose to love him and serve him? Well, this is why. So that means there has to be temptation. That means there has to be evil in the world. So that's the old Epicurean argument, the one that atheists or agnostics are so fond of try to argue against the existence of God, with that evil exists, and if God were good, there would be no evil. Well, that's their understanding. That's not God's understanding. There is a purpose for the existence of evil, and that's why there is. So as soon as a person chooses, when there's temptation, as soon as anybody makes the choice not to do the will of God, then they've done evil, and so you've got evil in the world. So that to provide man a choice automatically then introduces evil into this world. And what's a big part of that? As soon as somebody chooses to do evil, how often is that going to end up causing there to be some victim of it? How many evil things are done that don't hurt somebody else? Very few. How many things do we do that only hurts us and no one else? There's not many. That's the reason why. What did Jesus say was the greatest commandment in the law? To love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The way the Lord knows that we do that is by our having temptations, tests on our faith to overcome, to show that. What's the second greatest commandment? To love our neighbor as ourselves. And Jesus said, everything that God has commanded rests on those two commandments, which is why we see in Romans chapter 13, the Lord is quoting several of these ones that were in the Ten Commandments that are, of course, also part of the law of Christ in the New Testament. He says in Romans 13, verse 9, "For this thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law." Now, all those commandments that he just gave right there, if one somebody breaks it, it's going to hurt somebody, and it's going to work ill to their neighbor. So he said, thou shalt not commit adultery. I mean, that's not a victimless sin. Thou shalt not kill. Well, just ask Abel. He was the first victim of that at the hands of his brother Cain. Anytime murder is committed, there's going to be a victim. Thou shalt not steal. Well, you're stealing from somebody. I mean, that's working ill to somebody. Bearing false witness. I mean, if you're giving false testimony, I mean, you're testifying against, you're lying about somebody else. You're falsely accusing. I mean, that's going to hurt someone. Coveting. You're coveting something that belongs to somebody else. I mean, all of those things. That's why he said the commandments of God rest on loving God and loving others. If we love God, we're not going to do those evil things. But if we love others, because God teaches us to, we're not going to commit those sins, because they're going to work ill to our neighbor. And loving our neighbor and working ill to our neighbor, those don't go together. Those are opposites. So we can see the reason why it's necessary that there's evil in the world, and that means innocent people are going to suffer. And it's sad to see that. Now, God's going to judge all of that. He teaches us not to do those things, but he's going to judge all of us for our actions. And I mean, if we live our lives here and we don't do right, and we're hurting others, and then we're going to answer the Lord for that. All of those are very serious matters, of course, which is what he's teaching about here in James 4, and why we need to humble ourselves and be subject to God, submitting ourselves to God, and resist the devil, and the devil will flee from us. But we can understand why it's God's will that the devil will return. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we have that great promise from God here. As we saw on display with Job in the Old Testament, the Lord makes this promise to us in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you, he will not allow you, to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." That's a promise of God. So are we ever going to face in our lives a situation that's beyond what we are able to bear, and that there's no path to do right through that? God promises he's going to make that way for us, that we're going to be able to bear it, and we're going to be able to find a way to escape it and be able to accomplish the will of God. We have that. That's one of the great promises from God there. But we can also see that it is God's will that we do suffer the temptations. It's necessary. And then a big part of what we saw in the book of James, the very beginning of the book, he even tells us to count it all joy when that happens. And why? What happens every time that we have a test, a trial in our faith, we face temptation, and if we do resist the devil in that, what's going to happen then? We're going to grow more. Our faith is going to grow. We're going to grow in endurance, and then all of the things that all of the works that patience, endurance will accomplish in us. That has the ultimate aim that he brings out. And just to revisit James 1, 2 through 4, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations. I mean, at first glance, that seems that seems completely backwards or like it makes no sense. Well, it does if we understand what he talks about next. Count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations, knowing this. If we don't know this, then it will seem crazy. But if we know what he's teaching us to know and we understand it, then we will be able to count it all joy because we'll understand the purpose of it. He says that knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. Perfect, that word means complete, as we know. So he's not teaching us that we're going to have led a sinless life on this earth, but he's teaching us what the goal or purpose is in our spiritual growth, that we be complete. And as we know from other passages, that we are complete in all of the parts of the love of God, that we are fully complete in his image and entire, spiritually lacking nothing. So there's the goal. But that comes through our enduring temptation. So that's all part of resisting the devil, and he will flee from us, but he's going to have to be back, because if he never came back, then whatever amount of patience that we grew in from the last go-around, in the last battle where we overcame the devil, if he never came back and we never had any more temptations, then what's going to happen with our endurance? It's going to stay right there. I mean, how could we grow in it more unless there's more temptation, more trials on our faith? But when we've been through a bout of that, when we've been through a round, I mean that takes a lot. It's something that it requires a lot of us. We pointed out last week what happened when Jesus went through a 40-day session of temptation there in Matthew 4. And when he overcame all of that, what did the devil do? Departed from him for a season, didn't he? Yeah, he would be back. But do we need rest from the temptation when we've been through something like that? When we've been through a trial, do we need some rest to recover? And the Lord knows that, and he gives us that. And so the devil's going to flee from him. The Lord's going to make sure the devil, he's going to have him chased off from us for a while. And then when we're able to take it again and be able to take more the next time because we've grown some from the last, well, he'll be back and we'll go through that again. But so it's going to go in that step-by-step fashion. I mean, that's what our lives are like. So is it going to be smooth sailing? Are we going to have, where does the Lord promise that following Christ means we're going to have an easy life? It's all going to be no problems, no stress, no troubles. I mean, that's the opposite of what he tells us is going to be like. We're going to have lots of trials, lots of tests on our faith. But God's with us in all of it. It's never going to be more than what we can bear. We can always, he's always going to give us that way of escape through it. That's how we grow, as we overcome those things. And then we'll have more to go through the next time. But this is that process. And so he says we need to submit ourselves, therefore, to God and resist the devil. Well, then, what goes along with submitting ourselves to God and resisting the devil? Verse 8, draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. So when we're resisting the devil, what are we going to be doing? Well, how well are we going to resist the devil if we're not drawing near to God? How did Jesus resist the devil? In Matthew 4, we looked at that last week. And when the first temptation, when he was out in the wilderness and he had not eaten for many days, and the devil tempted him to turn the stone to bread so he could eat. He was hungry. Well, is there any temptation if you're hungry and then, hey, you can get food like that? That rock right there, you've got the power to turn that into bread and you can eat it. That he did. He also understood the purpose. Now, keep in mind the context. What's the last thing that happened at the end of Matthew 3? Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan by John the Baptist. The Holy Spirit descended upon him in the form of a dove. At that time, he was given the power to do miracles. There were no miracles done before that. So he received the power to do it at that moment. He hadn't done any miracles, but he's got the power to do it now. The devil knew that. So here's Jesus now with the power to do miracles. Could he have turned the stone to bread? Did he have that power? He could turn water to wine. He could walk on water, raise the dead. Could he turn a rock into bread and eat it? Of course he could. Five loaves and two fishes fed 5,000. He could have done that. What was the purpose of the miracles? As Jesus put it in John 5, it was his Father's testimony that everyone would know that he was sent from the Father and that he was speaking the Father's words. Well, who was out there in the wilderness with him to witness the miracle, to recognize the witness of God, to know that what Jesus was saying was the Word of God? There's nobody there. So how could it fulfill the purpose of the miracles? Would that have been a proper use of the power? No. So Jesus understood that would not have been in keeping with God's purpose, to use it strictly for himself, to feed himself. That would have been contrary to the purpose. So he recognized why that would have been a wrong thing to do, but then what did he say to the devil? How did he resist that? Hungry as he was. It is written. And what did he say? That's right. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. He knew what God said, and doing what God said goes above the physical food. The spiritual food outweighs the physical food. And he knew the Lord would provide for him. He had that trust in the Lord, but he was not going to misuse his miraculous power and to feed himself and go against what God said. But he said, it is written. And that's how he overcame every temptation. Every time he says, it is written. So when the devil tried to get him to cast himself off the pinnacle of the temple, quoted a prophecy about God's protection of him with the angels, what did Jesus say? It is written. The devil quoted the scripture accurately, but of course he misapplied it. It was not a promise for God to protect Jesus if he was going to go cast himself off the pinnacle of the temple and tempt the Lord. So Jesus said, it is written again, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Then the devil tempted him to fall down and worship him and promised to give him all those souls that he had. Jesus came to save all those souls. And instead of having to go to the cross and die for them, here, I'll give them to you right now. Just fall down and worship me. What did he say? It is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. But every time it is written, it is written, it is written. So he overcame, he resisted the devil by knowing the Word of God. what's a big part of drawing? How do we draw near to God? I mean, that's a big part of it, isn't it? To search what He has taught us, to learn what His will is. I mean, that's a huge part of drawing near to God, where we love Him and we want to know what He says. And so we seek that out and diligently search His Word to grow in our knowledge and understanding of it. We've got to do that. That's what Jesus did. I mean, what was He doing at the age of 12 in Luke 2? I mean, how much seeking had He done? I mean, there He was as a 12-year-old, and I mean, He had more understanding than all those ones that had been studying all their lives. So Jesus was very diligent in seeking His Father to draw near to Him. And of course, what do we also know? Throughout all of those, every situation He was in, just as an example, when Jesus came down from the mount after He was transfigured, He took Peter and James and John up there. Where were the rest of the apostles? They were down there in the village teaching, and there was a child that had an evil spirit in him where he couldn't talk. And what had they done? They'd attempted to cast that devil out, but they had failed. And it's the only mention of a case of a failed effort to perform a miracle by ones who actually had the power to do it. What was the problem? Jesus cast that devil out, and they came to Him and they asked Him why could He do it, but they couldn't. And what was the answer? This kind of comes out, not out, but by prayer and fasting. What had He obviously done that they hadn't? Now, had Jesus prayed out loud? Very unlikely, because if He had prayed out loud, Lord, remove the devil from this child, do you think one of them might have said, we didn't do that? It would have been pretty obvious to them if He had been. It's doubtful they would have not caught on to that problem if He had done that. Now, when He prayed in John 11, before He raised Lazarus from the dead, Jesus said why He was praying out loud then. He prayed out loud for everybody to hear on that occasion. And what was the reason? For their sake, so that they would know. Which again is indicative. Did He always do that out loud where others heard it? No, but what do we know that He was doing all the time? Anytime He was going to perform a miracle, anytime He was, what was He doing before He, when they were going to come and take Him? He knew that night when He was going to be betrayed, they were coming to get Him. And he knew the scriptures, all the prophecies. He knew what He was about to go through. That's the part that is just very difficult for me to conceive of and how He was able to face that and go through it. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. We find ourselves in the middle of a situation and if we're following the Lord like we should, we try to find the right thing to do in all those situations. God gets us through those things, but in any of us in our lives have had some moments, some times when some things were very, very difficult. What if we had actually known ahead of time, right when it was going to happen, what was about to happen? Would that have changed how we approached it? Or would we have been looking for a way to not approach it at all? Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen, and he went right into it, eyes wide open, fully understanding everything that was coming upon Him. He knew all that He was about to suffer. And He did it because that was His Father's will. But what did He do in the garden before, when He was facing that, before that happened? He prayed. What did he spend all night doing before he chose his 12 apostles? Spent all night in prayer. I mean, how much of Jesus' time was spent in searching, studying the scriptures to know his Father's word, and also in praying to him? Is that part of drawing near to God? And if we're doing those things, then what has God promised to do? He's going to draw near to us. So he will respond. He's going to respond to what we do. And actually, he's going to respond to what we do either way. We need to understand how God works. But this is the very encouraging part of it. If we're seeking him and drawing closer to him, he's going to be coming closer to us. And that's a promise from him. So we're not going to ever be in a situation, if we are sincerely seeking after our Creator, that we're not going to find him. We're not going to be out here all alone. We're not. He's going to be right there with us. In fact, when we see God's work described in a few verses before we run out of time tonight, but Psalm 14 and verse 2, this is also repeated in Psalm 53 verse 2, word for word. So we have this twice spoken in the book of Psalms, and it really should get our attention if the Lord has repeated himself in his word, on which he does a few times, but he doesn't do that for no reason. So this is something obviously that's important to know and understand. But he says in Psalm 14 verse 2, also in 53 verse 2, "The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God." This is one of the things that God is doing. He's made every soul that's on this earth, and he is looking upon them to see if there were any that understand and seek him. Is God looking for ones? Is he looking for ones that are seeking after him? Hey, that's what he's looking for. What does he do when he finds that? Well, now if we read the other verses in that psalm, he doesn't find it much. That's the sad part. I mean, there we got today 7 billion people in the world, and the Lord is looking down from heaven to see if any do understand and are seeking him. And how many of that 7 billion and whatever millions does he find doing that? Very few. But that's what he's looking for. And what does he do when he finds those few doing that? He responds to that. Remember in Genesis 18 when he was about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham was pleading with him there, and he started at 50, and what did God say? He would have spared those cities. It wasn't just one, it was the cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah, and there were others, smaller ones all in that area, but those cities there, God destroyed, but he would have spared them all if he had found what? 10 righteous in there. There weren't. But it would have made the difference there. God's looking for the ones that are seeking him. He says this also in John 4, 20 through 24. Jesus was at Jacob's well, and there was a Samaritan woman there who met him. Now the Jews didn't talk to the Samaritans. They were bitter enemies. But Jesus saw this woman here, and he taught her. So she had a question here in John 4. She said in verse 20, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain of Samaria. And ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." So what's her question? What's the right physical place to worship God? Is it the mountain of Samaria or is it Jerusalem? So her understanding of this is based on something physical. And how many religions or religious practitioners have a similar understanding that you've got to be in a certain place or facing a certain physical location, that there's something holy about a physical location on this earth that's connected to God in some way? Is that actually true? Well, not according to what Jesus taught, but that was her understanding. So what did Jesus answer? Verse 21, Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when you shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship you know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews, but the hour cometh and now is when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. I mean, God's not a physical being. And is he worshiped with men's hands? And is he found in a physical location? And is he, do we offer him physical things as our worship? I mean, that's not what worshiping in God in spirit and in truth is about. But notice what he says about God and what he's looking for, that God seeks such to worship him. God is seeking for the true worshipers, the one that are seeking him to worship him in spirit and in truth. Is that similar to what we saw in Psalm 14 and verse 3? Yes, it is. Verse 2, rather. Yes. So in Acts 17, when Paul was in Mars Hill in the city of Athens on his second missionary journey, I think I've mentioned before, Ishar and I got to go there before. Actually, Hannah was there. We have a picture of it. She was on a leash. she was on a leash at the time. So we didn't want her to go off of Mars Hill. But anyway, we were in Athens, and we got to go there on that that place. It's not a huge... it's right below the Parthenon there in Athens, but it's not a huge hill. But with the vantage point where it is, when you're up there, I mean, you can see the city. You really can see the whole thing right there, all spread out before you. And now today, you know, when we were there, I mean, you could see the kind of the onion domes on all the Orthodox church buildings that were throughout the city. I mean, that's what was the dominant feature. But just had the perspective when Paul was standing on that place and preaching this in Acts 17, he was at a vantage point where you could have seen all of those, the temples that they had, which they were numerous from what he was saying, and they had these altars everywhere. And they wanted to make, they covered all the bases and wanted to make sure they didn't leave one out. And so they even had an altar to the unknown God. So just to make sure they didn't miss him. So Paul was there on Mars Hill here in Acts chapter 17, verses 22 to 27. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, You men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you're too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, To the unknown God. Whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. They had the same problem that Samaritan woman did. They didn't know who they were worshiping. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. Is there similar teaching here to what Jesus taught in John 4? God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And then verse 26, And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. So in verse 26, God has made of one blood all nations of men. So he's made us all for what reason? Verse 27, that they should seek the Lord. He's put us here so that we would do what? That we would seek him who made us. If haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. And that's a description of how our seeking God begins. I mean, spiritually we're blind, we're in darkness, and we're feeling around in the dark, but we start feeling after God. I mean, when we start seeking God, is it with full spiritual sight and understanding that we do that? No. But when we start to feel after him and we turn our hearts towards him to try to understand, and God is looking down upon men to see if there are any that understand and are seeking him, and if he finds that feeling after him, if he sees one, there's one that's reaching out for him, what's he going to do? He's going to respond. He's going to be found of them. I mean, that's why Matthew 7:7-8, if we seek, we'll find. I mean, that's one of the great promises, that if we seek, we'll find. If we ask, we'll receive. If we knock, the door will be open. God's there, ready to respond, and promises that he will. And he's not far from any one of us. So even when we've been in rebellion against him, doing our own will, we start to turn to him. He's right there. He's not far. Because he's there looking to see if there's any that will seek after him. He's not far from any one of us. So if we draw near to him, he's not far away as it is. He's going to draw near to us. So we're seeing the work of God and the nature of God. And God is very merciful and very loving in doing that. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. This is another one of those great promises that goes along with that. If we draw near to him, he's going to draw near to us. Is he going to walk off and leave us? He's not. Hebrews 13:5. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So if we draw near to him, we have absolute certainty he's going to draw near to us. And he's not going to abandon us. He's not going to leave us. He's not going to forsake us. He's going to be there always. That's his promise. Now, very interestingly, also in Hebrews 7, verse 19, a contrast between the Old Testament law and the law of Christ, the New Testament. He says in Hebrews 7:19, for the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by the which we draw nigh unto God. So as we start to feel after him, he's not far from any one of us, and he's going to draw near to us. But the more we draw near to him, the more we seek him, the more we grow in him, and he's provided a way for us, as we saw at the beginning of James 1, where we can be complete and entire, lacking nothing. That's the same word there, that perfect, to be complete. But that's his purpose. But as we are conformed more and more in the image of Christ, as we're seeking him more and more there, we're going to be drawing near to him and doing that by seeking after his purpose to fulfill it. And he will be very pleased with us when we humble ourselves to do that and seek God in that way, with that understanding of his purpose that we're trying to fulfill. God's going to be drawing near to us. Now, last thing, we're going to look at two quick verses that show that's the opposite side. We need to be aware of this. When he says he will draw near to us, it's conditional, isn't it? We have to draw near to him. He says he will never leave us nor forsake us. That's also part of the condition, that we're drawing near to God and not forsaking him. If we don't draw near to him, he's not far from any one of us, and if we start to seek him, we will find. But if we do refuse him and we do not seek him, and we reject him, and we forsake him, what's going to end up happening? First Chronicles 28:9, this is what King David said to his son Solomon. First Chronicles chapter 28 and verse 9. These are very good words for a father to teach his son. He says, "And thou, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a perfect heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searcheth all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee. But if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever." I mean, David understood that. He was a man after God's own heart. 2 Chronicles 15, verses 1 and 2. We'll close with this tonight. 2 Chronicles 15, 1 and 2. "And the Spirit of God came upon Azariah the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa, and said unto him, Hear ye me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin, the Lord is with you while you be with him. And if you seek him, he will be found of you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you." So when he says, "I will never leave you nor forsake you," is that conditional? Yes, that we don't forsake him, and that we do draw near to him and continue to seek him and draw near to him. Then he will draw near to us, and he'll never leave us nor forsake us. But what if we turn away from him? If we reject him, will he forsake us? He will. So there, God works in both those ways. So he responds to what we do, good or bad. But as we know, he's not far from any one of us, and he's looking for us to seek after him, encouraging that. And he will respond to our seeking and be there. So when he says he gives his grace to the humble and encourages us to humble ourselves under him, to seek after him and resist the devil, he's right there and says he's going to draw near to us if we will do that. And he's going to help us to grow and fulfill his purpose. So we have that, some very great promises from God in that. We'll continue there, Lord willing, for the last part of verse 8 next time, next Wednesday night, Lord willing.